for this morning's session is Karina Kelly, and she's doing Seeing the Big Picture Through Little Windows, Testing the Usefulness of Small Corpora for the Conservation and Revitalization of Te Reo Māori.
Kia ora tātou. Tēnei e mihi a kawatu ana ki a koutou, engari ko te mihi tuatahi, kia ora tauma. Ko huri kitu o te ārai, i runga i te mohi o norata ki ngā reo e kōrerohi ana i tēnei rā. Kārua ko te mihi atu ki a koutou ngā kānaka Māori, te mana whenua konei tēnā rā koutou, o tira tēnā tātou i te hunga ora. It's appropriate that I should start my presentation this morning and try and stay close to the microphone at all times. I apologise if I wander. With an acknowledgement for those who have passed, not just because that's a traditional Māori custom, but also particularly apt because at least one of the corpora that I'll be discussing in today's presentation contains their language, so it's appropriate that we should start with that. And of course an acknowledgement to the mana whenua here. So I preface my presentation with those greetings, and thank you all very much for coming. My name is Karina Kelly, I'm from Victoria University in Wellington. I'm going to be speaking about the Māori language. I just want to check, how many of you are familiar with that? Not Māori speakers, but you know which part of Australia you're from? Great, okay, that's great.
Excellent.
Okay, so just a quick run through, more of as a reminder for myself, I suppose, than anything else. I'm going to start off with a little bit of background. Now, many of you may be familiar with the fact that we've got this Māori language in New Zealand and that on a world stage we're considered to be doing reasonably well when it comes to language revitalisation. There's a little bit more recent information that I think is important to share, and so I'm going to start with a bit of background there. But mainly, this presentation is going to centre around two studies that I've been involved with. The first, my PhD, and the second, a tribal organisation-based investigation of dialectal distinctiveness. And so I'm going to talk to you about some of the results that we've found and some of the issues that we've encountered, and the benefits that we've discovered stem from doing this sort of research with the active involvement of the community about whom the description, whose language the description pertains to. So if you can just bear with. Okay, so we're 40-some years into active Māori language revitalisation in New Zealand, and thus far the focus has been on producing more speakers of te reo. So taking people from zero Māori to some Māori has been the overall aim, as well as expanding the lexicon, really, to enable the use of Māori language in different domains. So what's resulted is obviously a change in the demographic of the Māori language speaking community. And so nowadays, I mean, the most recent estimate is that somewhere between 10 and 23% of the community of Māori language, active Māori language speakers, are first language speakers of Māori. So the influence that L2 speakers have on the shape of the language as a whole has been the point of much discussion within the Māori language community, much despair amongst some sticklers for traditional Māori, and much angst for Māori language learners and parents who are endeavouring to raise their children speaking Māori. And some more recent developments, and this relates to the second study that I'll be discussing today, the Te Tūrere o Māori, so the new Māori Language Act, which took effect last year, has brought about a significant change in the administration of funding, governmental funding that's set aside for Māori language revitalisation initiatives. And perhaps the most significant thing is that it's now led by a group of kind of democratically appointed tribal representatives. And I'm going to use democratically in as loose as possible to you, but all of a sudden we have a committee of people who are responsible for representing the views and needs and desires of their tribal areas, who together decide how Māori language revitalisation funding is to be distributed and upon which kaupapa, which initiatives it's supposed to be spent. And so what we've found has stemmed from that has been a real avid interest in research that can shed some light or provide an opportunity for people to assert their dialectal distinctiveness. And I think that's probably one of the main reasons that we got funding for the second project I'm going to talk about. But one feeling which still is rampant among the Māori language community is that linguistics, and in some instances even just the notion of grammar, is seen to be really distinctly un-Māori, very foreign, possibly invalid. And so what drives me as a Māori speaker and a Māori mother and a Māori language teacher, as well as a linguist, is the opportunity to present this type of study, this creation and dissemination of the results of corpus-based study for the benefit of this Māori language community. So that's the focus of my presentation today. Okay, so my first study was my PhD study, which was an investigation of syntactic change in te reo Māori through time. Now, I did that through creating two snapshot corpora, two synchronic corpora from different periods. So one designed to capture Māori as much as possible before dramatic English influence, so from the period pre-1900, and the second one to capture as much as possible the shape of Māori language as it's spoken today. So I worked with post-1990 material, and it's important for me to mention here that both of these studies thus far involve only written material. So obviously the oral recordings from pre-1900 were rather scarce. So we stuck with written material, and I'm absolutely aware of the sort of skew that may have in the findings, and we'll talk a bit more about that in just a minute. So I really wanted to trial this methodology and see, could I really come up with some valid, quantifiable evidence of language change in the period of time between these two snapshots? And what's more, could I do that using tiny corpora? Teeny, teeny, tiny, 100,000 running words. 102,000 running words, I should mention, but about 100,000 running words in each. And so just a slice, a smallest fraction of what would typically be considered study-worthy size corpus. So this was my intention. I was kind of building a picture of what Māori language looked like and was used like in the past, and what it looked like and is used like now. And I was hoping that spot the differences exercise was going to bear some fruit as far as giving a sense of how the language had changed. But what was really important here is I was looking at the syntax and not just the vocabulary. So lots of anecdotal evidence, comments within the language community, were talking about them perceiving changes in the language that was spoken today. And so we would have the L1 grandmother who found the speech of her L1 grandchildren unintelligible. So the pieces of text which people were still struggling to read, and this was L1 speaker to L1 speaker with only 50 years in between them. So these are the sorts of experiences that were being had in the language community, and it was a part of that. One of my favourite teachers of te reo, Timothy Karetu, so a staunch language proponent, once said the problem with the L2 learners is that their incompetency becomes the norm. Now, I was an L2 learner and teacher, so that made me feel fantastic. But aside from, and very fair, I mean, I think what he was trying to capture in his typically tactful and gentle way was that speaking behaviours of an L2 speaker in an environment like what we have in Aotearoa really have a profound effect on the shape of the language overall. And so I thought, as a little PhD student, that I might try and see if I could capture some evidence of that. Okay, so I built these two corpora. I had to digitise the traditional corpus by hand. That was a moose of a job, especially considering the vast majority of these naturally occurring texts were handwritten and 100 years old. So what I did find is that we had some really clear results. We could absolutely, within the comparison of these two small corpora, provide some robust evidence of changes in frequency of some high-frequency grammatical particles, things like the preposition more, typically translated as for or about in Māori. The other thing that we found is that much of this evidence actually contradicted those anecdotal claims or the speaker intuitions. So typically though, what we found is that speakers would say, oh, this is used all the time now. This language feature was never used in the past and now it's there all the time. And what we found was in the past it was there as well. So there was stasis where people had perceived an increase in frequency. And what's more, an interesting consideration came out of the results of the first study when I realised that statistical significance, that was what was driving the study at the very beginning. I was really after some kind of robust evidence of change. But some of the findings which weren't statistically significant still had a very real practical significance within the language community. And so while the emergence, for example, of the new applications of traditional language features, and I'm going to go through a couple of examples with you shortly, they really highlighted for us that sometimes, as a linguist, I was looking for the right sort of statistical significance, and yet when I would take my findings to my language community, they would not at all care about that, but would be completely fascinated with things which were outliers to the main body of data. So here are a couple of examples. Statistically insignificant, practically very significant. So the use of the preposition more in Māori, when it co-occurs with a singular personal pronoun, there's a special cliticized pronoun that's used. So the preposition more in combination with the singular personal pronouns o for I or me, koe for you singular, or ia for the third person, we instead have a different version. So the second person here, the combination of more preposition more with first person, second person koe, we would, in traditional Māori, would expect to hear more. And what we found was that in the modern corpus, that these non-cliticised pronouns were popping up in combination with this preposition, which was to the despair of every traditional Māori, every Māori language teacher that I know, couldn't believe that this was happening. But one thing that I should point out is that one of the selection criteria for the modern corpus was not only that it was naturally occurring text, but also that it was produced by anybody who was adequately qualified to teach Māori anywhere in the country. So these were all adults, language models, and they were producing the sort of thing that was despaired often by their own teaching. So the fact that it appeared at all, and especially within a corpus of such a small size, was statistically insignificant, but practically very significant. Something else that popped up was this evidence of new syntactic environments. So the question, kia ha tēnei mō? Kia ha tēnei mō? So, meaning, what is this for? In Māori, it just doesn't feel Māori, is the way that it was described, but it's incorrect to have this hanging preposition at the end. And what we can do is a word-by-word translation. If you accept that hiaha is a phrase meaning what, and tēnei means this, and mō is for, it's really easy to see how we're ghosting in English construction there, and that flies in the face of the traditional Māori construction. So the fact that this turned up at all in a corpus, a very small corpus, created by language models in the community, was a point of much consternation within the communities that I shared my research with. And there were other examples as well where this small corpus managed to capture English influence on Māori. So the question, ka tae au ki te haere ki te wharepaku, using this verb tae to mean can as a politeness convention, when really in Māori it's just talking about a person's capabilities. So it's often mentioned, you know, a student will ask, we'll use tae as a politeness convention, and the teacher will say, well, of course you're capable of going to the toilet. It's the old can and may. Did anybody go to Catholic school and get taught by the nuns? Was it just me? Okay, I'm glad I shared that with you all.
Right.
The other one that was interesting, a much smaller, lower level really, but just a simple substitution. So the preposition more in the second example, ka kimi au mō taku ki. More being used as the preposition for the complement to kimi, to search, obviously following that for, I will search for my key, which had absolutely no precedent in traditional Māori, and so it was showing that the traditional preposition, which we would expect for the direct object of a canonical transitive verb, would be e, and here it was being just taken as a parallel for what we would expect in English. What else was really interesting about this small little study is there was an opportunity for us to capture change that wasn't just about the influence of Māori, influence of English on Māori, but instead captured evidence of change that was internal to Māori. So we were finding there was a shift away from specificity, and I think what I mean by that is that, for example, tense aspect mood markers, which were time specific, would be avoided, and there was an expansion instead of the continuous tam e ana. There was a lack of reliability among passive marking within the modern corpus, which just showed that people were really relying on the root words within an utterance to construe meaning and the application of common sense. And what's more, it also captured, because this was a written corpus, it managed to capture some evidence of changes in at least the perception of vowel length. And so more, which would typically be a long or sound, indicated by the use of a macron, was instead being written in the modern corpus in many instances without the macron. Now that lines up with some of the Mounsey results, who are saying we're detecting a shortening of the long vowels in Māori. So, but it was interesting nonetheless for us to have a study that was first, that was really saying, hey, there's change that's internal to Māori here. It's not all just English influence. Okay, so the second study, which is reasonably new, we just began this last year, and that was really as a result of me sharing my results with my Māori language community, and then with the establishment of the Māori Language Act, which meant that Ngāti Kahungunu, amongst others, were going to have representation on this, what's called Te Mātāwai, for the administration of Māori Language Revitalisation Funds. So there was an appetite for a study for information that would help us better understand the dialectal distinctiveness, particularly in this instance of Te Reo o Ngāti Kahungunu. So Ngāti Kahungunu, this red area here, so towards the southeast of the North Island. And so their motivation was they really felt that getting a little bit of information was going to help them and help inform their teaching and their language planning through providing a means to promote their points of difference. So far the study has just, we've built a corpus. This corpus is actually 300,000 running words, but there are certain criteria which were applied to my first study in order to ensure that we had that balance of comparability and representativeness, which were loosened somewhat for this community-based corpus study. So where I controlled strictly to watch for individual speaker bias, individual speaker behaviours dominating the overall picture within a small the small corporate used for my PhD. Here we were dealing with a far smaller pool of speakers, and so we wanted to capture as much as we possibly could. So we've ended up with 300,000 running words in the first study that was completed this summer, was concerning the locative preposition, which is typically K everywhere else, but which Ngāti Kahungunu really strongly felt was kai within their region. And from our 300,000 running words, we ended up with 350 occurrences. And I mean, the statistics were pretty clear. We had 87% of those occurrences were kai. What was interesting, though, was that when we accounted for speaker bias, what we found is actually only about a third of the speakers, just under, or actually a quarter, of all of the speakers of the kahungunu corpus were actually using kai. The vast majority were using the same as everyone else. And so this became a really interesting discussion with that community, at least with the with those who were involved in the research, where we thought, oh, actually, this is really timely, because in an age where we're encouraged to kind of put a stamp on your dialectal distinctiveness, sometimes there can be such a hunger for what makes you different that you overlook what makes you the same. And so in overlooking the sameness and looking for your distinctiveness, there was a skewing of the picture, a misrepresentation of the use of this particular bit of evidence of dialectal distinctiveness within the language of that community. The other part that was really interesting is that we had four speakers who used both, and of those four speakers, two of them used them as different parts of speech. So depending on the type of word that was used in the complement, they would use kai for some contexts and k for the others, and the other two used it indiscriminately. So there were some key considerations that underpin both of these studies. Firstly, as Sally was mentioning earlier, accessibility is a key issue, and I think it was particularly important that this collection of text, much of which came from private collections, was seen to be being cared for and was also going to not be taken away but made accessible to those who had a hunger and a desire to learn more about it. And so the digitisation process in order to make those materials accessible was really fraught with a whole bunch of problems, not least of which it meant that every single student and many of the people who were assisting as research assistants in these projects were my students, but many of them were L2 speakers. And but what was an absolute requirement is that we couldn't outsource that transcription to anybody, because the accuracy rates for speakers for non-speakers of Māori were just too poor to make it cost-effective. So it was really necessary that those involved in the project would have an in-depth knowledge of the language. And then the other thing that we found when it came to accessibility was the contributor reluctance. So partway through my PhD, I had a bunch of people who had contributed to the modern corpus just lose courage. They just started to doubt themselves and feared that any analysis of their text would be the perception of any errors in their Māori language production would be a mark against their Māoriness. And so that became a real issue. What we also found within the kahungunu corpus was there was distrust, because we hadn't had an opportunity to share this research and explain what was involved and how it could be valuable for their families within kahungunu. And I'm not kahungunu, I should point out. I'm not kahungunu, I'm from much, much further north. And so I was an outsider. So I think it became really important that the results of this research was shared with the community. And then, as I've mentioned previously, balancing these notions, these really important principles of corpus linguistics, but balancing comparability with representativeness was a real issue. So when you're dealing with a traditional corpus and there is limited material available, and if I was trying to create these two snapshot comparisons, then one might say, okay, well, all of the contributors to the first study were male. So the traditional corpus was just male, that's the material that we have. But it would be limited in its usefulness if I was just to create a corpus for the modern period, which contained only male speakers. So I think just trying to say, no, in that instance, representativeness trumps comparability. Balancing those two factors was a real challenge. And what's more, the mode, the genre, and even the tribal affiliations of the speaker became other really important considerations. So for the Kahungunu corpus, of course, it was important that we were capturing the reo of Kahungunu speakers. So then the next question is, well, what happens to my tipuna who's from the north but lived in Kahungunu for 20 years? At what point do I become considered to represent te reo o Ngāti Kahungunu? So those sorts of issues around the validity of the inclusion of some of the material became another tricky little balance. But amongst the benefits I've discussed already, some of the most important ones was really just to begin an informed discussion on notions of language change, and also a cautionary tale for those who were actively involved in language prescriptivism. So what's really important about this corpus study is it provided an opportunity, it's an alternative source of information, of language input, for those who are raised starved of it. And so this was an opportunity to provide a different means to either endorse the speaker intuitions that we had, the anecdotal evidence that was available, but also to remind people of their sense of agency. So for Māori language speakers today, that there is an opportunity for them to be discerning about the sorts of changes that they're going to endorse in their Māori language teaching programs and which ones they're going to dissuade their students from following. And so I think in opening that discussion, instead of just either being resistant to any perceived change in Māori or accepting of all of it as an unavoidable consequence of the time, it's been really exciting to see how these sorts of studies and this little bit of information can remind my people of their sense of agency in this little age of language revitalization. That's it. Thank you very much. Do you have any questions? Just to say, standing up. Kia ora.
Did you study any speech rate? Because that's something that our elders always make comments about.
Speech rights?
Yeah, the speed, like the tempo.
So again, these corpora are all about
written. Right.
Yeah, so I mean, I could tell you what some of the handwriting could surely let me know how fast they were writing, but aside from that, Ngāti Kahungunu have been so wrapped with the results that they've gotten from this first study that they've decided to expand their corpus to include a whole bunch of oral recordings, which is really exciting.
Right.
But that's phase two, I don't have anything.
But what is your understanding of what people perceive on that?
Do you mean faster, slower,
yes.
What is it?
More of an English cadence, I would say.
Yeah, in many instances they talk about intonation as opposed to speed. So it's the high-rising terminals that are so ever-present in many New Zealand English speakers' kind of language styles. That they say that there's this sing-song musicality that comes through with language learners, with L2 speakers in the modern period. But then again, there's this a whole spectrum of opinions. So I've heard one of the kuia I had a conversation with was like, I am sick of this machine gun Māori. It was like machine gun Māori.
Yeah, that's
sounds
what
brutal. But it was about this rat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat.
Yeah.
Now there was whether or not that was about the speed of delivery or actually about the kind of phrasal complexity, was another really interesting thing.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
day. Any more questions?
So what were the big vocabulary differences?
Do you mean in the first study?
Yeah.
Yeah, so some of the big ones included the use of phrases as a whole phrase as a verb. So for example, I should point out that my PhD study just had three. I was designed to give a good broad test of the methodology, but there were just three case studies. More, that preposition I was talking about earlier. Taya and ahe, there's two verbs of ability. And then a grammatical construction with the relative clauses. So what I found though was the use of more showed the expression mō taku he, meaning like for my sins, a way of saying sorry, being used as a verb to apologise. So that was interesting. And rejected as well by most older L1 speakers that we spoke to. But a dramatic increase as well in the use of more, possibly not unexpected given the mirroring of the English use of for, and so it was popping up in many more instances. Yeah.
So I had a question.
Mm-hmm.
So before, like, the English influence on the language,
mm-hmm.
Was the speaker, when he was speaking in the language, was the focus more on, like, the person or the verb, or the location of the person and the story?
Sorry, run your question by me again.
The language, is it more before influence of English, when a speaker would be speaking in the language, and how he would be speaking, would the focus be on the verbs, like the person, would it be focused on the person, or would it be focused more on the location?
Okay, so I'm not really sure how to answer your question, to be honest. Mary, can you help me out? Yeah, I'm sorry. What we found was interesting about the traditional speakers versus modern speakers was definitely, we have these two directional particles, mai and atu,
mm-hmm.
typically talking about towards the speaker and away from the speaker. And in traditional Māori, the mai and atu would relate specifically to the subject of the sentence. In traditional Māori, the use of mai or atu would mean toward or away from the point of reference. And in modern Māori, that was much more confusing. It was, people weren't clear about their narrative,
yeah.
So, and how that affected what they should be doing with mai and atu. That's the only bit of information I got that might relate.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I'm sorry, we might have to just wrap this up because there is a round table coming in. Questions,
Thank you very much.
Sorry, I'm